And here we're back on the Logic Consortium. And today we're lucky enough to have Dr. Raul Hinojosa-Ojeda back on the line. Doctor, are you there?
Yes, I am. It's good to be back on the air with you guys.
Thank you so much for coming back. Of course, today I kind of wanted to talk about the unaccompanied minor.
Uh-huh.
What's going on, what everybody's talking about. And, of course, you came out with this article, and you were on. You were just down there a couple of weeks ago. I think you got back only about 14 days ago. Is that correct?
That's right. Actually, I'm going back there tomorrow as well. Uh-huh. Yeah.
So you're going back tomorrow. Where are you going?
Well, actually, the president of Mexico is coming to L.A., and then I'm going on Tuesday to meet with presidents of El Salvador, because we're trying to come up with a regional strategy here on how to talk about this and propose positive strategies to the U.S. government about how to deal with this issue. And so anyway, that's what we're going to be working on. And it's based on the type of findings that we released in the report. And there's going to be a new version of that coming out, which strengthens all those conclusions. And which, you know, basically says that this is primarily an economic inequality issue about why we have migration, and that we really should be fundamentally changing our laws. We bring people here, but we make sure that they don't have rights to come and work here and create value here. And that's got to end. That's the fundamental problem, right? And that's what this crisis shows us. The what we've been able to see from the crisis is that you have children coming here. But it is not some unusual surge. This is the most logical consequence of having the unemployment rate of the United States go down. It happens every time the unemployment rate goes down. You have more immigrants coming to fill jobs, and they bring their kids. It happens all the time for centuries, in fact. Definitely in U.S., Mexico, Central America over the last 50 years. So what's happened new is that they finally had recognized that there were many children coming from Central America who, again, were coming here since 30 years ago when the United States funded a huge civil war there that brought migration from nothing to historic heights, what it is right now. And they've been coming, but their children had a much more difficult time getting here because they had to be sent across borders, various borders, to get here. So the consequence was that children show up like they've been showing up from Mexico for years, unaccompanied. That is, that their parents, they weren't with their parents. They were with some other people that were taking them to be with their parents. The law changed in 2008 that said, no. If they're not from a contiguous border country, Mexico or Canada, you need to interview them and take them before judge, because they may be eligible for some type of humanitarian relief. That's the law. That's a good law. It was passed in 2008. And what's happened is that we're now interviewing children. So what was basically, we used to say 95%, oh, yes, sure, they're accompanied, because nobody bothered to ask, are now being interviewed, and it turns out 85% of the children coming from Central America are indeed unaccompanied. They're coming to be with their parents. This, from a sociological perspective, this is nothing new, but apparently it shocked everybody, which is good. It's good because it's now allowed us to focus attention on the issue, which is how do you solve the problem? What is the root problem here? The root problem is there's poverty in Central America, and there's a great deal of violence going on all the time. And we are bringing workers here because we need them to be here. And their parents, therefore, are separated from their kids. What should be the answer? We need to have a legalized process of people to come here to work and to have the right to bring kids.
So, okay, let me take a step back. First of all, right, our listeners, we're speaking with Professor Raul Hinojosa-Ojeda, professor of Chicano and Chicana Studies at the University of California, Los Angeles, expert in immigration who's just been down there, and we're trying to talk about this recent reports. There have been a ton of recent reports that have been talking about that there's a new phenomenon. This is what the reports say. There's a new phenomenon. Since October, there's been a surge in unaccompanied minors from Central America, from the three, mainly from three countries, Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala. And in those reports, we're seeing reports of people talking to the kids and saying, why are you coming up here? So everybody kind of thinks, hey, they're coming up here because of the I mean, this is what kind of people are saying. They're coming up here because of the violence, and it's a new thing. So you're saying we need to talk about, that's not the case. We need to talk about this much differently. So how are people talking about it now, and how should people be seeing this differently from a new angle?
Yeah, correct. It's not wrong to say that people are fleeing violence and poverty. That is absolutely the case. What the problem is that it's being presented as something of a crisis, a brand new phenomena, all right, which is actually leading Congress people to make bad decisions, even the President of the United States to make a bad decision. Because what they said is everybody has now agreed, oh, my God, we now have to speed up the process of reviewing these kids to deport them faster. Because nobody in this country is in no mood to support refugees. Politically, that's the read of what's going on here, okay? And so ironically, this metaphor, which on the one hand is a very compelling metaphor for the media, actually ironically ends up feeding a negative reaction from particularly the Republican conservative base that has come to the conclusion, you know, forget kids as well. You know, we are not going to have immigration reform. We are heartless, and we want to kick out kids faster than anybody. And that's what was going on in the GOP in a reaction to this story of a growth of kids, right, on the border. And what we're saying is, wait a second, this should not be an excuse all of a sudden because the data is coming in that you are all ignorant of. This should not be an excuse to actually hurt kids. Okay? This should not be an excuse to do away with what is a good law, okay, which is that people need to be interviewed if they're coming here as undocumented children to see what type of assistance you can be providing them.
And that's
right?
To be distinguished between the law vis-a-vis Mexico, where the children are not entitled to full hearings, full deportation removal hearings. Is that correct?
And that is correct, which, by the way, in our paper we call for the fact that Mexico should also be allowed to have the same rights as these Central American kids. You know, we should, in the end of the day, you know, this is, A, the humanitarian thing to do, and it's actually dealing with the humanitarian blowback and leftovers from our broken immigration system, all right? If we were, you know, a serious country ready to fix our immigration laws, which everybody has agreed are broken, then you would not have this absurd situation whereby we bring in the workers, we know we need them, everybody's agreed, nobody's going to throw them out, okay? Well, I don't see any Republicans arguing for 12 million deportations, okay? So that means they're here, they're working, fine. Oh, guess what? They always have kids. That's what human beings do. It's the most powerful force in the universe, all right? And you're going to tell me you're going to keep them away from their parents because you can't figure out what type of legal work status you're going to give these folks. Not tenable, right? You are going to have kids, all right? Then the question is going to be, under what circumstances are they going to be brought in? The only way they can come in now is undocumented, right? And they're trying to get back with the family unit and then to be able to create the future lives, which are better than them maybe being abandoned, abused, or neglected where they came from and maybe join a gang. But, you know, so we need to move. That's the critical recognition here that what we need to do. We need to fix these laws. We need to take care of these kids. And most importantly, finally understand that there's the root cause of this migration is as real, because we need these workers, as is as real as the poverty down there. And this is the final really important point that hopefully the American public can learn at this point. Dealing with the root causes of poverty and violence in Central America is not that expensive. In fact, it's a teeny part, a teeny bit of the billions and billions of dollars that we spend annually on militarizing the border of the United States, right? We just saw the reactions of over-militarization in Ferguson. We have a apoplectic orgy of military spending and on the U.S.-Mexican border, okay? That is now the irony. This is another report that we're just about to release, which is that we used to pay $2,000 per capture of an undocumented worker crossing the border. We now pay $30,000 for each apprehension because we have now overloaded it so to an absurd amount that we used to, each Border Patrol agent used to capture 340 people a year. Now they capture 32 a month. I'm sorry, a month. Okay? It's absurd. So what do we need to do? We need to refocus our militarized border expenditures for economic development in, for example, the country of El Salvador, just to give you an example of what I'm talking about. I was just with the Minister of Defense just a couple of weeks ago reviewing an analysis of how much do all the gangbang members make a year doing what they do. The vast majority of it is micro extortions, right? Protection rackets, okay? And it turns out, guess what? It's about $60 million, okay? $60 million. And in a country of 7 million people that's very poor, that's a lot of money. Compared to the United States, where the president is arguing for a $3.7 billion emergency infusion of money to further militarize the U.S.-Mexican border as a reaction to this situation, is another incorrect response to the facts and how they should be interpreted, all right?
And the president, he's also suggested a change in the law to make it more akin with Mexico in the sense that the kids wouldn't be entitled to a full and fair removal hearing. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely.
And flooding the border to make more immigration judges to get them out of here faster. So what's been your response to the president's reaction to this?
Well, you know, the president has actually for better or worse, been relatively consistent. You know, he thinks that being macho on enforcement gets him something, right? You know, he's playing cards with the devil here, right? Of which he is playing the other side at the same time. The Republicans have never, warmed up to his incredible expenditure levels or even the deportation levels or even now this latest attempt, I think, at doing this. So I really question the judgment. Maybe he has a view that what he's going to do, and this is what I think everybody's expecting him, what's going to happen now that we understand Obama a lot more, is that he will try to, quote, lead from behind. And after the elections, he's creating a mood, which is what he likes to do, of a crisis right now. This helps him, I think, keep the pressure up. And to be able to argue after the elections to do what he really wants to do, I think he's convinced of doing that, which is deferred action to really move a lot of people into a legalized status, temporary legalized status due to executive order. I think that he's ready to do that. I think it would be a calamity to his presidency if he does it. I think he's clear on that. Okay, so in the meantime, he probably thinks he's putting money in the bank this way. And by the way, I've actually heard very high-level people that have met with the White House very recently describe it as that. That this whole his stance on the on accelerating is that, deportations is that he's willing to be tough. He's willing to be tough, but he's therefore to be able to argue that because the Republicans never stepped forward to take this seriously, he's got to start now acting. And it was never because he was never tough. It was just that they were never able to act. And I think that that's where he's placing himself politically. And unfortunately, these children right now are pawns. Now, what I do argue in the paper, however, is that what we should be doing in the short run, and I think the president can do this, is that he should go the other way and give the same status to Mexicans, for sure. All right? And I'm going to tell the president of Mexico that tomorrow. And that should be a demand of the Mexican community in the United States also. But at the same time that you do, you know, this very commendable thing, which I certainly hope he does, which is a legalization, a temporary legalization. And I would think in the order of about 5 million people, that's a good thing. We want to congratulate him on doing that. But to make sure that within that new set of executive orders is included the changes in the way that unaccompanied kids are being treated. And to let them, if they have parents here that have already been working here for a certain amount of time, that they let them stay with them. End of story. Okay? That would do a huge benefit, I think, in terms of both relieving the quote crisis, doing it his way, the way he wants to do that. And, you know, again, I mean, I think what's gonna happen in this country is that he's gonna do that, and I think that the 2016 election is actually gonna be a referendum on that, and I think the Republicans are gonna get screamed, I mean, completely creamed on that. And I think the Democrats and Hillary probably are gonna capitalize on that, and they're gonna get mass Latino turnout, which they should, because the stakes will be high. Because in the next election, if Obama does this, which I fully expect him to do, the next president would have to, the candidate would have to say whether he's going to or not continue that policy. And if the Republicans are stupid enough to run somebody that will say that they will absolutely discontinue that and start deporting these people, you will have the 187 scenario in this country. And what is the 187 scenario? That's exactly what happened in California. After the Republicans, Pete Wilson, did a basic, huge anti-immigrant, a strategy, and thinking that electorally it would win him, which in the short term it did. He did get reelected, but what it did is it moved millions of Mexicans, this anti-immigrant legislation that he was supporting, it moved millions of Mexicans into, voting. And that is why California now is a permanent Democratic blue state in all statewide elections, because of that folly of the Republicans, actually, ironically. And you know, and I think that that's what I'm reading even too much of a strategic vision in terms of what if the Democrats have a strategic vision. It's a smart one, okay, on immigration. And then I think, you know, because in the end of the day, we have to extend these rights to people. There's no other way out of it, and the only party that will do that will be the Democrats. But we have to keep pushing for against these tendencies that the president has shown again and again, and a lot of Democrats show again and again, which is to try to, quote, be balanced. And the balance usually ends up with a lot more money for militarization of the border, okay? You know, we have to have our Ferguson moment. We have done this enough. We've militarized enough, okay? And actually the irony of all of that is that it's not needed once you start legalizing people, because then you don't need to have this absurd, wall. And finally, the irony is that on this militarization, what it has done, it has stopped migrants from leaving the country. Okay, before there used to be a lot more circular migration, which in a more perfect world with a saner immigration policies, people could go in and out, be here for a few years, work a few years, leave their family back home and go be there. That should be the way we should do it, which is the way it used to be. But because of the militarization of the border, now they have to work here and cut our tomatoes, raise our kids. Oh, and by the way, I'm sorry, they're going to bring their kids too.
Dr. Raul Hinojosa-Ojeda, thanks so much for checking in with us on the unaccompanied minor crisis, and have a great trip down to Central America, and we look forward to checking back in with you when you return.
Always fun talking with you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
And this is the Logic Consortium, your bi-monthly dose of politics and policy. And we're lucky enough to have in the studio Dr. Mara Enya, mayoral candidate for Chicago. Hello. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi. How are you?
Good. So, of course, you're a PhD in education policy, an attorney from Chicago. You're doing all sorts of things. I was trying to look into your what you've been doing since law school, and I see that you're on the board of the Austin Chamber of Commerce, executive director, CEO of ACE Municipal Partners. Can you kind of tell us a little bit about yourself and how you decided to run for mayor?
Well, like you said, and you know a little bit more about my background from law school and beyond. So I got my master's in education, and then I went to law school, as you know, and then I got my PhD in educational policy studies. But even before then, education and social justice had always been a part of what I did. It was how I was raised. My parents really instilled in us a lot of social justice values, these values of integrity, of activism, and of responsibility that we have to the community. And so that was how we were raised. And so it undergirds all of the work that I did and the education that I received. I grew up in the Chicago area, spent a lot of time on the north side in Rogers Park, Uptown, Edgewater area, and saw a lot of what was happening in the city, in the neighborhoods. Just a lot of things that from my perspective, were going wrong. And so part of my experience, I went intentionally to work in City Hall in the mayor's office because I knew that I needed to understand how these decisions are being made, who's making those decisions, why, and who's not at the table. And so my experience in City Hall in the mayor's office working across policy areas really opened up my eyes even further to a lot of the inequities and a lot of public policy things that we don't do as a city and the voices that are not included in policy decision making. So from there, I went straight to the West Side and started working as executive director of a nonprofit. I was also working simultaneously in the manufacturing sector because of this issue of workforce development and how we create jobs in the economy. And then from there, I moved on to executive director of the Austin Chamber of Commerce and started the consulting firm working with municipalities. So everything that I've done has really been around how to use what I have learned to serve as a bridge builder between those who are making policy at the top level and those of us who are organizing on the ground.
So in terms of policy changes, I know one of the big things that you've mentioned is injecting a dose of democracy into the school system. And one thing that you've suggested is an elected school board.
Yes.
So can you kind of tell us what that would look like and how it compares to what's happening right now?
Well, right now, the school system is directly controlled by the mayor. So the mayor has mayoral control. This happened in 1995 under Daley. And what that means is that the school board is entirely appointed. Now, the issue with this is that the mayor chooses those individuals that are on the school board. So if he has a particular agenda or ideology, he can select school board members that follow his ideology. And so it really eliminates the voice of the people, really the parents and people in the community whose children are attending these schools. And so that dose of democracy is to say that we're going to bet on democracy. We're going to bet on the fact that those of us who live in the communities, who have children in the schools, should actually have a part in playing in making decisions that will impact the school district. And that's why this elected school board issue has come up. It's also because people are feeling that their voice is not being heard, that a lot of the activism that took place prior to the school closings, a lot of people felt that there was no good faith and fair dealing on the part of CPS with the community in how the schools were closed and in the reason behind the school closings. And so people are just feeling locked out of the process. They're feeling that their voices are not heard. And so we need that democracy to make sure that they're included in the decisions that impact their lives.
So what would it look like? It would be a policy change to make sure that the members are in elected positions.
Yeah, so it's a legislative process. This actually happens in Springfield. That's the way it was changed back into the hands of the mayor, was through legislation in Springfield. And so we would essentially go through that process again, but instead we would take the power out of the hands of the mayor and have it instead be an elected school board.
And you talk about how that maybe might cause an increase in funding. What would the change be? Obviously, the school board wouldn't be tethered to the mayor,
right,
and wouldn't be under his thumb and be able to be beholden. So maybe they would be more brave in putting forward new policies?
Well, new policies that reflect the voice of the people. I think people just want to have a say, particularly those who are invested, those who live in the communities and have children in the schools. They want to know that their voice is being heard when decisions are being made. That's what they're looking for. And that results in policies that more closely reflect and align with the needs and desires of those in the community. And so having a say in how the school closing decision was made could have helped to mitigate some of the damage from some of the schools that were closed, or in what happened after the schools that were closed. And so people are really looking for that voice, and that's the key thing that they want. Not necessarily to have complete decision-making control, but at least to they can be rest assured that their voices are included in the policy decision-making process in a meaningful way.
I know that there was a big education panel, I think, only 3 days ago.
Yes.
And can you tell us a little bit about it and what was talked about and what went on?
It was a fantastic panel. It was put on by Apple, which is the association of it's a principals association. So this is actually groundbreaking because it was the principals who are now being much more vocal about what's happening in their schools. A lot of what we've heard has been either from the teacher's perspective or CPS perspective. So this panel was organized by the principals. It included several key individuals in education policy. So myself, there was Troy LaRavier, who's a principal at Blaine, which is a school on the north side, a high-performing school on the north side. We had Dr. David Stovall, who is a principal with the Little Village. There were a couple of teachers, Tracy Barrientos, who is, I think she just transferred to another middle school. And we had a teacher from France who has been living here for about 8 years and was really doing that comparative assessment of what's happening in other contexts internationally and comparing that with what we do in Chicago. And so that panel, it gave us, the topic of the panel was designing quality school systems. And so we were able to discuss from our perspective, what does it take to create and sustain high quality school systems? And of course the moderator was Terry Mazzani, who's the current president of the Chicago Community Trust, but he also was the CPS CEO for some time. So he has a strong background in that.
So obviously one of the big topics in education has been these closings of these 50 schools.
Yes.
And then also, and I think it might have begun with Mayor Daley, Renaissance 2010, with respect to this push toward charter schools.
Yes.
So, I mean, how should we look at this push toward charter schools? Is it something that we should welcome, or is it something that we should be skeptical about?
We should be very critical. We should be very critical and very cautious, because if we want to see what happens when we are not critical and cautious, we only need to look north to Milwaukee and look south to New Orleans. New Orleans right now has no public neighborhood schools and is completely charter run. Milwaukee was an early adopter of the charter school model, and they have been struggling. And so that's where we should look if we want to see what the future of Chicago looks like under this paradigm that the mayor and the administration is pushing. And so the problem with charter schools is that they are no substitute for strong public neighborhood schools. Our top priority as a municipality, as a city, is to support our public neighborhood schools because they serve all students. What happens with charters is that they can pick and choose which students they accept, and so they're able to pick, for example, the more quote-unquote desirable students. But what happens to the children who are not able to get into a charter school? We have a responsibility to make sure that regardless of where a child lives, no matter the neighborhood, they have access to a high-quality education. And that means that those schools that are lacking in resources, we actually should be investing more into those schools. But charter schools, the model has not, it has not been proven. The research does not indicate at all that charter schools outperform public schools. And in fact, the research showed that was revealed at this panel a couple of days ago showed that our public neighborhood schools are actually showing greater growth in terms of student achievement than charter schools within the school district. So the research doesn't support this move toward charter school proliferation. And in fact, it's been quite harmful. I think it's setting up a dual education system, and that's unacceptable as a city.
But there, on the whole, charter schools do not outperform public schools. But there are certain charter school networks that are doing a nice job. I believe Noble Square does a nice job. And so should we kind of be more, we decide more carefully who we give our charter schools? charters too?
Well, we can say for sure that, yes, there are some great charter schools, there are some horrible charter schools, just like there are some great public neighborhood schools and there are some horrible public neighborhood schools. However, we really have to think about what our core commitment as a municipality is. It is to our public neighborhood schools. That's where we have to prioritize. And that's why I talk about a freeze on charter schools. We have to take the time to really assess how we can make the necessary investments into our public neighborhood schools before we start shifting and allocating resources to charter schools. And so that's what the freeze on charter schools is for. It's not to say that they're all evil across the board, no. But the research doesn't support that they're better, and our primary responsibility is to public neighborhood schools that serve all the city's children.
And so, in terms of education, the main push is this independent school board.
Yes, elected school board.
Elected school board. Kind of moving on, which is a similar topic, is the aldermen, the way that they're elected and how they're tied to the mayor. I've seen you mention that before. Can you talk about what the current state of that is and how the aldermen are related to the mayor and what you'd like to see happen?
Well, I think we're at an historic moment in this city. I think one of the critical things that we need to do at this point is make sure that we are electing aldermen that share our values, so values of the campaign, but also aldermen that are independent, whose primary responsibility is to serve their constituents. The current model is a strong mayor, weak council system, and it's actually supposed to be the opposite. It's supposed to be a strong council, weak mayor system. So when we have that, it allows for the aldermen's first allegiance to be to their constituents, and that should be their first priority. Right now, we have so many aldermen that are beholden to the mayor. Part of that is because low voter turnout, so many of them haven't really received that many votes to get elected to begin with. But the other is that if they receive, for example, funding from the mayor, then their allegiance becomes, they essentially become a rubber stamp for the mayor instead of serving the constituents in their ward. And so part of this campaign is that it's more than just the office of the mayor. This is about transforming city council also from top to bottom to make sure that we're electing individuals who share our values, who are independent, and whose top priority is serving, is being public servants and serving the constituents in their ward.
We do have a caller. Caller, are you there?
Yes, sir.
Yes, you had a comment?
I did, and I unabashedly support Ms. Lewis, and thank God.
Well, this is not Ms. Lewis. This is Amara Enya.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Candidate for mayor.
Well, what an idiot I am.
Okay.
Well, your ideas are great, and I you've got my vote.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Enyia is the last name.
Yes.
Thank you very much, caller. So the way the current aldermanic structure is set up, it's more that the people are always trying to garner support of the mayor.
As in the aldermen are trying to garner support of the
yes.
mayor? Well, I think what happens is, so the first issue is the voter turnout in the wards. So if an alderman was elected by, say there are 50,000 people in the ward and only 1,200 came out to vote, who are you really representing? You're really not representing your true ward. And so if the mayor now says, I'm going to put $50,000 into your campaign to support you, then is your allegiance to the 1,200 people that voted for you, or is it to the mayor who put $50,000 into your account? And so the problem that we're seeing is so many aldermen who are not operating in the best interest of their constituents, because whenever the mayor calls and says, hey, I need this, or I want you to do that, or support this legislation, they end up going, siding with him, in some cases, to the detriment of their ward. And so that's why when we talk about independent aldermen who are there to serve their constituents first and foremost and to legislate, that is their role. They are not supposed to be there in the capacity of a rubber stamp for any piece of policy that comes out of the mayor's office.
So do we want to kind of limit the amount of influence the mayor can have over the aldermen by limiting contributions or something like that?
Well, I think campaign finance reform is definitely a step in the right direction. It needs to happen. I think it is dangerous for our democracy when we have so much influence by moneyed interests, particularly with our aldermen and with our mayor. But again, it requires us to ensure that we get the voter turnout. We have to increase voter turnout so that the people are electing their aldermen. And so that requires us to do work on the ground.
Let me remind our listeners. Today in the studio, we have candidate for mayor Amara Enya. Talking about, she's a PhD in education policy, lawyer, has experience in the community, and as the executive director for the Austin Chamber of Commerce, heads up a municipal consulting firm, ACE Municipal Partners. Amara, can you talk to us about I mean, it's amazing. I see your T-shirt right now, Jackie Robinson West. What a run they had.
Yes,
wow.
Indeed.
I definitely watched the full game yesterday, and I didn't get to see the full game today, but I did see that they did lose to South Korea. But they did win the U.S. championship yesterday, which
they
was amazing.
I've been wearing this shirt for, the last 5 days.
It was so exciting yesterday.
Yeah,
they played their hearts out. Those guys are amazing. Mm-hmm. The way they have quick hands. It's really amazing. So that's been some great news for the city, and everybody's kind of talking about that in the context of how the city gets a lot of press on the negative side for the amount of violence that goes on.
Yes.
And everybody's saying, what, it's some great news to bring to the city, which it is amazing. These kids, inner city guys taking care of business against the juggernaut of Las Vegas. These guys all get personal coaches and play all year long, and we're on the south side here, and these guys are, what a coach, I believe.
Fantastic.
He's amazing. What
fantastic.
A demeanor he had.
Yeah, fantastic.
He was so great with the kids. So, talking about the problems in terms of violence in the city. I know one thing that you talk about is restorative justice.
Yes.
Can you talk about what that is and how you see that playing a role?
Yes. Restorative justice, it builds accountability to the community and it diverts individuals from having any contact with the criminal justice system. We know statistically that once an individual has that first contact with the criminal justice system, the likelihood of having a second and a third and so on is so much greater. And so as a matter of prevention, we have to keep people from having that first contact to begin with. What that means is instead of doing things like proposing mandatory minimums or locking individuals up for whatever acts were committed, we help people to understand why the offense took place. It means that there's community accountability where they have to, whatever restoration needs to happen, they are accountable to the community as opposed to going straight into the criminal justice system. There are other aspects to it as well, something we call peace circles, where a lot of individuals that are in some of our more challenged communities are experiencing severe stress, mental, emotional, because of the conditions of poverty. And so when it manifests in different ways, it might manifest in a violent way, for example. So how do we help those individuals process through those emotions based on what they experience? I've seen many children who are dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder. These are young children, elementary school children, middle school children. And so when they act out, we have to help them process through why they're experiencing those things and how we can help them work through so that they're not acting out in violent ways. That's all encapsulated in restorative justice. So it's a much more comprehensive and much more preventative approach to addressing the issue of violence. It's getting more to the root causes as opposed to locking up individuals or pretty much just sending people to jail.
So how do we go about implementing something like that?
Well, the city has attempted to implement restorative justice practice in CPS. At a mental health hearing that I attended at City Hall last week, they were saying that the Chicago Department of Public Health was going to invest about $370,000 more into restorative justice programs. I actually think it should be part and parcel of the city's public safety strategy. This means that it should be included in every school. This means that even within the police department, some of the tenets of restorative justice should be a part of the training so that our officers understand what it means and can even take part in the process because it's community building. And so I think it's not enough to just have it as a side program or boutique type program. It should be part and parcel of our public safety strategy, both in our schools and within the police department.
So this is a big part in terms of reducing the violence that's going on.
Yes.
This plays obviously a role in terms of policing tactics too. Do you suggest if you were elected mayor, what would you do in terms of the police and how they go about arresting people? I mean, I know a lot of people talk about, they're arresting kids for little marijuana exchanges when they should be going after violent people. I mean, what would be the focus of the change in terms, not only restorative justice, which sounds to play a huge part, but are there other changes you'd like to see implemented in terms of police strategies, police tactics?
Definitely. Three major things. The first is in the training. protocols. So what we've seen happen over the last several years is a shift to a much more militarized type of training for police officers. Now, police are different from military personnel. Police are tasked with serving and protecting. And so their training should not actually be militarized, because what happens is they, when you see individuals as suspects or as potential offenders first, you will automatically begin to act a certain way toward them. And so what we need to be doing is having them trained so that they see all individuals as residents first, as people first. They have to be humanized so that when they engage with them as human beings with respect. And this is a huge issue, because what we're seeing is a breakdown in trust. There's a severe deficit of trust between the police department, the police officers, and the individuals that are being policed in their community. And I think a lot of that has to do with this militarized training, where even departments are receiving military equipment, which we see what's happened in Ferguson, Missouri, when they have tanks. They have the sorts of firearms and firepower that is reserved for the military. And I think that's very problematic. The second is that community engagement piece, having them understand the community, the context of the community in which they serve. I will not go so far as to say that only a certain race can police a certain community, but any officer that's placed in a community should understand it deeply. That means that when they're in the community, they're walking around, they're talking to people, they're establishing real relationships. It should not be that the only time someone engages with a police officer is under negative circumstances, when they're being searched or they're being followed or some other negative interaction. It's about relationships, and that's what helps to build trust. The third piece is accountability, making sure that there is some accountability for police officers when violations do occur, when misconduct occurs. We spent, in the last 10 years, the city of Chicago spent over $500 million in lawsuits because of police misconduct complaints that were filed. That's money that we could have been using for infrastructure investments, expanding our restorative justice practice, for our workforce development. Instead, we're taking all of that money and spending it on these lawsuits. So one part of the conversation that's coming up now is the use of body cameras for police officers. I think that if we make that kind of investment in body cameras, for example, we can reduce the amount of money that the police department in the city of Chicago is spending at the back end in lawsuits. And that would guarantee some level of accountability so that people can say, if I have a complaint, at least there's some record of what happened. I mean, again, what happened in Ferguson, Missouri, where, you know, who's telling the truth? How could a body camera have resolved that? I mean, we have cell phone cameras that recorded the event, but with police officers wearing body cameras in many cities across the country, they've shown a substantial decrease in the number of complaints that are filed for police misconduct or excessive use of force.
So one of the other big issues is corporate partnerships. One quote, Rahm wants to turn Chicago into a city of lights, but he can't even keep the lights on, the street lights on in the neighborhoods.
that's from personal experience.
So tell us about that specific quote and about how you think that's a reflection on the bigger issues.
Well, you know, I live in the East Garfield Park community, and for a couple of months, or maybe it was a month and a half or so, the lights on my street were off. Now, of course, this is an issue with our aldermen and making sure that they're accountable for getting that service request taken care of in a timely fashion. But it really is a public safety issue. I mean, when you're in a community that's fairly challenged, there is a fairly high crime rate, you don't want the lights to be off on your street. And so when you juxtapose that with the mayor's proposal of a downtown light show, first of all, we have to think about how much money are we spending on that downtown light show, and who is it for? It's not for residents. It's for tourists. Now, yes, tourism dollars are important, but we have to make sure that we're taking care of the people who actually live in this city first. And so this comes down to an issue of priorities with our budget. When we have the funding, how are we allocating it? Should we be spending it on what I consider a frivolous project downtown for people who do not live in Chicago? Or should we be making sure that we're able to provide the nuts and bolts services for people who actually live and pay taxes here in this city? And as a resident, I would like my streetlights to be on before I go downtown to see a city of lights.
And you talk about bridge building between those that make policy and those that are affected by policy.
Yes.
This is an example.
Yes. I mean, this is critical for me. What we need is someone who Because I see myself as a bridge builder, someone who understands the top levels of city government, but who has the same experience at the grassroots level. And so the question is, how do we bridge that gap between those who are making decisions at the very top and those of us who are organizing on the ground? We need someone who can bridge that gap, who can take the knowledge. And this is why my experience in the mayor's office was so critical, because it allowed me to take the knowledge that I had learned and now translate that into my grassroots community work so that we can maximize the efforts of our organizing, so that, we can see results. And I think that's so important. We need more people who understand what happens in the decision-making process so they can convey that information to those of us who are organizing on the ground, to the average residents, because that's how you empower them to be able to make changes in their communities.
Let me remind our listeners, you're listening to the Logic Consortium. Today in the studio we have mayoral candidate Dr. Amara Enya, education policy expert, attorney, community activist. So maybe some of the listeners haven't heard about you out there. How can they find you?
They can go to the website, www.amaraforchicago.com. That's AmaraForChicago.com. We are also on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and every form of social media. And it is all at Amara for Chicago. So they can sign up to volunteer. They can donate. We are asking for people's support. We're heading into petition season starting this week on Tuesday. And so we're collecting signatures. So we need donations. We need people to sign the petition so that we can reach our goal and get on the ballot. This is our historic moment, and we want to make the most of it.
So the election's in February.
Yes.
And what's the story with respect to, is there a primary election, or is it everybody part of one party, or what's going on with that?
So the February 24th election is a primary. If no candidate receives 50 plus one of the votes, then it goes to a runoff election in April between the two highest vote getters.
So some of our listeners may not have heard you out there. Give them your pitch why they should vote for you.
This is our historic moment as a city to move in a completely different direction with new leadership, leadership that has no baggage, leadership that is truly committed to seeing the entire city move forward. We need a unifying message, and that's what this campaign is about. We need to bring the city together. This is not about personality politics. This is bigger than that. And so we have to, if we say we want the kind of change that needs to happen in this city, we have to be willing to move in a completely different direction with different leadership that's committed to the benefit of the entire city as a whole. And so what I represent and what this campaign represents is the city of Chicago tapping into the power that we have as a democracy to say that we are looking for people that are working on our behalf, public servants. And we have to take advantage of this opportunity because there's a sense of urgency about the change that needs to happen. And so if we want unity, if we want to move forward in the collective benefit, we have to make sure that we elect people that share the values that we just discussed.
And so what would be your first act when coming to office?
Well, the first act is definitely to, in hiring, I mean, that's where it starts, hiring individuals who share the values that I've been talking about, who understand Chicago intimately, who are committed to the collective benefit of the city, hiring individuals whose first priority is to serve. And that cuts across every single department, from the police department to CPS, to streets and centers. I mean, every department, we need to have individuals that are speaking the language that we speak. That's the first thing that we would do. I mean, we have many policy changes that would enact, but it really starts with that systems change. This is a systems level change that needs to take place in the city, and it flows into every area of policy thereafter.
And we do have a caller. Caller, are you there?
Yeah, hi, how are you?
Yes, you're on with the mayoral candidate, Dr. Amara Enya.
Well, it's a real pleasure. How are you, candidate?
I'm good. How are you?
Very good. It's nice to hear you. I was just wondering, on education, as far as, like, Karen Lewis, how are your views stack up against hers? Like, how do you compare and contrast?
Well, seeing as how she has not declared and hasn't put out an official platform, but I think there's some clear things that I talk about that might resonate with some of the issues that have been put forth. So an elected school board, this move, shift, the need to shift away from over-testing our kids, the need for more arts and vocational education is something that I'm strong about, a freeze on charter schools, supporting our teaching staff. These are some of the things that our campaign, that my campaign, puts forth. And I know that there's alignment with some of those things with Karen Lewis if she decides to run, what her platform would be.
You know, one thing that we didn't cover in education is that there's this feeling that there needs to be 100% college bound. But you haven't necessarily said that that should be the focus, that there are so many other jobs out there that can be filled with more type of vocational education.
Yes, I actually think that is an incorrect assertion, that 100% college bound, 100% college ready. I think it is not consonant with the realities of our economy, and it is actually not beneficial, because we know that not every student in CPS will go to college, whether because they can't afford it, they don't want to, whatever the reason. What we know in our economy is that there are jobs that are readily available, and we need to make sure that we're preparing our children for the labor force. And so there's so many jobs that are available in skills. So I worked in the manufacturing sector. There are literally thousands upon thousands of jobs that are available in that sector. But because we do not have a labor force that is skilled, a lot of those jobs are remaining vacant. And these are good-paying, family-sustaining jobs. And so there are other trades in healthcare, in IT. We need to make sure that when our kids graduate from school, that they have options. They have the option to either work if they want, go to college if they want, or do both. That is actually the most beneficial formula for the city's economy. We can't support our economy if we don't have a labor force that's trained for the jobs that are available.
Dr. Amara Enya, mayoral candidate, thank you so much for coming into the studio today. We're so excited about your candidacy, and we'll be following you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And we'll be back in 2 weeks. Thank you, everybody.